Safety First, TÜV SÜD's podcast on cybersecurity and more.
Welcome to Safety First. I'm Sabine Krömer from Corporate Comms at TÜV SÜD and your host. In today's episode, we have Steve Orrin as our guest. He is Federal Chief Technology Officer at Intel Corporation. We discuss how federal government in the United States is challenged by cyber attacks and what lessons were learned from major attacks like the SolarWinds supply chain attack. Welcome, Steve. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Steve, you are the Chief Federal Technology Officer for Intel Corporation. What is the scope of your role, actually?
Well, it's really interesting. The role actually has multiple aspects to it. We'll start with part of my role is to help translate Intel technologies and capabilities and features into government speak to help the federal government understand how they can leverage those technologies into their missions, into the enterprise, and leverage it into their ecosystem. So a part of it is external facing. The other part is then taking government requirements and translating them back into Intel speak so that our business units, our technologists, our architects and developers can understand the needs and requirements of the federal market and implement those into the next generation of hardware and software. I also own the strategy, solution architecture, and solution architecture teams for federalizing Intel solutions. And what I mean by federalizing is taking commercial solutions that we build for corporations and industry and the OEMs and adding the federal spin or making it mission specific so that it meets the needs of the federal use cases. And so a lot of our activity is working with our commercial solutions and the federal government to help them adopt those technologies and adopt those innovations into the federal environment. And whether that be the scale of the enterprise systems that the federal government has to deal with or mission-specific challenges that they have at the edge and in the cloud.
So this leads me directly to my second question, because as I understand, you are a representative of the private sector and you are counseling the US government on cybersecurity issues, right? So what topics are you driving currently and how exactly can Intel help the US government?
Starting with, the federal government has a lot of challenges just in the scale and scope of the mission and of their enterprise. And when you look at what are the current high activities we are working on with them, data protection is top of mind. How do I protect my data no matter where it sits within the cloud, at the edge, in the data center, across multiple agencies? Zero trust is the term du jour that everyone is using. It was mentioned in the cybersecurity memorandum and the executive order from earlier this year and from last year. And it really is not a technology, but an approach, a way of approaching cybersecurity that takes into account a lot of the things we've done in the past around risk and security controls and really applies a new approach to how you deliver it. The other key topic, you know, edge to cloud. Everything is moving to the cloud and moving to the edge, and connecting those two worlds end to end is a key area where we're helping them understand how do you secure data, how do you secure the systems that are at the edge, communicating to the cloud and back again. And then really focusing on the edge, because one of the things the federal government has a lot of is edge systems, whether those be industrial systems and critical infrastructure, military systems, civilian services, all of them have an edge component, and making sure we can secure that edge no matter where it is and as it's now a mobile edge is a key thing. And how does Intel help? It really comes down to four things. First and foremost, Intel has embedded security capabilities and technologies in the hardware and in the software we provide. And so our hardware comes with security capabilities, whether it be data protection, crypto acceleration, network security, threat prevention built in. And the software ecosystem and the enabling ecosystem that we use and we deploy is broad. Everyone runs on Intel. And so by using Intel technologies and that ecosystem of database providers, cloud providers, operating systems, security ISVs, together, we can bring that ecosystem to bear for the federal government and show them how to adopt those technologies. And then, as I mentioned earlier, one of the key roles that I have and my team does is to help take those commercial solutions and make them understandable by the federal government. And so that's something that we spend a lot of time on, is really helping them to adopt the commercial technologies around cloud, around edge, around networks and software defined, and make them operational in a federal environment.
Sounds like a lot of really important and vital things that you have on your list. Just to give our audience a clear definition, what exactly does the term federal government of the United States comprise? So, because they have their own cybersecurity people, of course, their own IT intelligence and anything, which authorities and administrative bodies take care officially of the nation's cybersecurity, like I think of the CISA, of the FBI and the NSA, and how do their tasks differ from each other?
So that's a very interesting question, Sabine, and it really is not a one-size-fits-all. Every agency across the federal government has its own cybersecurity teams. Some are larger than others. Some have different missions. Some of them are localized. You know, the Forestry Service has to protect the Forestry Service's systems, whereas CISA and DHS has a charter to protect all critical infrastructure, as well as the federal systems. The NSA and other parts of the DoD have auspices to control and secure the military and intelligence networks. And then FBI and DOJ have a law enforcement charter. But really, when you talk about the federal government, it's broader than just the agencies. The federal market really comprises of the defense systems and defense agencies, the intelligence agencies, and the civilian agencies, as well as what we call the defense industrial base, which includes the large system integrators and primes, federal OEMs, the federal arms of the Dells, HPs, and other OEM systems and cloud providers all have a federal division. And then, of course, the software providers, the Red Hats and the IBMs and CrowdStrikes all have federal parts of their business. And so when you talk about the federal market, it really encompasses that entire ecosystem of both the end customer, as well as the entire services ecosystem of software, hardware, and integration partners. And when we look at what their missions are and how do we address the cybersecurity problem, it is an all-in approach. Whether you're in the DOD, or the Department of Defense, and you're looking at defending the nation and defending military networks, or you're on the DOJ and FBI side and you're trying to do law enforcement and trying to do attribution, the missions will differ. But the security issues and security challenges are often fairly common between, whether that be attack prevention, data protection, detection of attacks, and the like. And so a lot of it really comes down to how do you apply the technologies and the solutions to the specific mission, understanding there's a lot of commonality between them. And ultimately, they have their own missions to execute, whether, again, that be law enforcement, critical infrastructure protection, and threat and attack detection. Ultimately, they need to use a lot of the same technologies, a lot of the same approaches.
Mm. So you just mentioned that they use a lot of the same technology, and I could imagine that it's also important to get to a common sense because of their so many different agencies and also many different private sector players. How do you get there?
Really, at the heart of it, we've seen this evolution across time of how do you move from these silos within the federal government and really within any organization to more of a interconnected, collaborative environment. Whether it be the need for information sharing that's driving it, the need for being able to do joint missions and joint collaboration, or the ability to execute the mission or to provide the services to the citizens requires data from multiple agencies, it's driven to a more collaborative approach. So how do we get there? Well, this is where standards can be very helpful. And NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, has been at the forefront of creating standards and reference architectures and guidance for not only the U.S. government and industry in the U.S., but globally, to how do you do things like cloud security? How do you do network segmentation? How do you do identity and access management? How do you apply risk with the cybersecurity framework in a common way? And so NIST has been at the forefront of publishing content to help provide those standards and provide those formats and those reference architectures that both industry, the U.S. government, and global governments all have the ability to adopt, and many of them do. At the same time, we've seen individual agencies like CISA and the NSA and others publish content about how best to secure systems so that the industry providers all have access to what their requirements are so that the industry is building to those sets of requirements or building the right security controls in from the get-go. And that really comes to how do we speed the time to deployment? How do we get from a technology into the mission area quicker is if that technology or that solution was built for those requirements. And so by publishing this information online on open source feeds, it allows for the broad industry to adopt the requirements and adopt those standards.
So in your opinion, are we good on a way on our road to common standards? And is this really developing in a way that you should say it looks good, like we have same approach?
It's very interesting. We are absolutely on the way. Are we there yet? Obviously not. You know, the joke is if you've got one good standard, you need 10. So the industry is working on this and working with the government to try to consolidate and try to provide interoperability. So even though within the industry, you're going to find different standards and different formats, one of the things that we've seen as a key tenet moving forward is the requirement for interoperability so that you can transition between systems, between frameworks. We've seen openness and open source initiatives around, you know, the Open Network Initiative, the Open Compute Initiative and others to try to create some foundational standards upon which then you can differentiate and innovate. One of the other areas that's really exciting is around API-driven and software-defined. So even if you have multiple standards or multiple implementations, you can use these sort of broker services or the software-defined infrastructure to transport information across those differing domains, those heterogeneous environments. Because the reality is that the world is still very heterogeneous, but there are these components along the way that allow us to connect things together. We've seen this in a lot of the industry getting together on cloud standards, being able to do open standards so that you could do multi-cloud. Even though the clouds themselves have their own proprietary interfaces and APIs, there are cloud brokering services, open clouds, and others that allow you to go transfer data across those and get out of the cloud jails as you would.
The cloud jail is nice. So let's talk a bit about how the federal government, what challenges they have. Let's go back there, because many organizations and companies, they really struggle with cybersecurity today. So the federal government in the US, what are their special challenges and requirements, and how is it different from the private sector?
So at its core, the federal government has a lot of the same challenges. It's just the scale of the criticality is at a higher level. The difference between most organizations in the private sector and the federal government in the public sector is the criticality of the data and the systems, the national security aspect. People's lives are directly affected. At the end of the day, it's that priority, that criticality of the systems, the national security aspect of them that changes the game. The other is the sheer scale. The size of the federal government systems and how many different agencies and people and data that it serves is much larger than individual organizations. So they have to do this security across a much broader scale, across multiple organizations. And the reality is that just like you find in many organizations, the heterogeneity of different decisions across time of which database you went with, which cloud provider, there are some agencies that have 5 or 6 different cloud providers, or in one case, 36 different cloud contracts. And so there's a lot of heterogeneity that has to be dealt with that you don't necessarily find in small, medium business. And then last piece, of course, is the threat landscape. The federal government and really all global governments are a significant target of threat actors, both nation states as well as cyber criminals. And so the threat is much higher as well as the criticality. And the last piece I would say that, you know, last two things that I think that make the federal government somewhat different from private organization is, number one, the federal government is really what we call mission driven. They're not in it for the cost or the profit. So there's not a cost savings as the number one. They do want to spend tax dollars correctly and they don't want to waste, but it's not about generating profit for shareholders. It's about achieving that mission. And so that focus changes the way they approach securing systems. But at the same time, they have strict regulations, compliance, and contracting that they have to adhere to that sometimes, you know, private organizations don't have the same level of regulation and compliance. It's both a blessing and a curse in some respects.
Mm-hmm. I understand. Okay. So let's talk about one of the major hacks from recent time, which is actually the SolarWinds hack. And this was one of the biggest cybersecurity breaches of the 21st century. So not because a single company was breached, but because it triggered a much larger supply chain incident that affected thousands of organizations, including the US government. So these supply chain hacks, why are they particularly serious? And also, second part of the questions, have there been lessons learned from the SolarWinds hacks regarding the US government? And what exactly was that?
So let's start at the heart of it. Why are supply chain attacks so serious? And I think at the core of it is that it's not a rogue file. And if you think about your classic malware, your Trojan horse, or other viruses that are out there, it's an illegitimate file that snuck its way into the organization, but you can still identify it as that's the bad file. In a supply chain attack, the threat is inside legitimate software. And so when you look at that software, SolarWinds was legitimate software that was running a critical infrastructure within most of these organizations. And when they went to it, they had the legitimate signature. It was from that organization. It was from SolarWinds. Everything about it was legitimate. It was the building blocks, or in this case, the dev process that was compromised along with some of the components inside. And so the key thing that made this threat so, and really other supply chain threats like Log4j and others, is that it's not just like a Trojan horse or classic where you've got a bad thing coming in, but it's sort of weird and you're looking at it, like, maybe I'll let it in. This was an absolute legitimate piece of software that was compromised from before it was delivered at the development side of the camp. And so a lot of our security controls at the time just weren't set up to detect that kind of attack because it looks legit. They say it's legit. Everything was legitimate. And it was only after it started doing malicious activity, and even then it was almost an accident that it was discovered, that we found out that there was malicious software on the inside. And so that vulnerability in itself was not a key area that was highly focused on. And a lot of the security controls really were run the software, make sure it doesn't break anything, and then let it go. One of the things we've learned is out of SolarWinds and really out of the other supply chain attacks is visibility is key. That was probably the number one thing we learned is we need to have better visibility, not just into our networks, not just into what's potentially malicious software, but even in taking a closer look at our non-malicious, at our accepted software, the software that our third parties are providing to us, and get visibility in there, something we have not had or not really had a strong requirement for. And it comes back to this concept of supply chain risk management.
So actually, the requirements for the supply chain, the software developing companies, were they changed or adapted after that?
So we're seeing this happen right now. There's a lot of activity. The cybersecurity memorandum, the executive order that the Biden administration put out, highlighted a couple of key things. It highlighted zero trust initiatives, which we can talk about, but also highlighted the need for software supply chain security requirements. And from that, really, are two things that came out of that. And NIST and other agencies are currently put out draft material on what needs to change. One is to have a supply chain risk management process so that you're evaluating all of the software coming into your organization for its risks, understanding who the company is, how trustworthy they are, but also doing deep analysis on the software when it comes in to try to detect. And the other big piece of that puzzle is a concept of a software bill of materials, or sometimes referred to an SBOM. And what that really means, and whether it's the SBOM format that's currently being worked on in the community or some other flavor of it, it's about having the developer and having the supplier document what's inside the box so that the customer can both verify that, but also track it. And one of the best things about this is if you have a software that comes in, you have your list of 20 components. When a notification comes out that component A, you know, a Log4j is vulnerable or has an exploit, you can quickly assess, does my software that I have in my organization have that vulnerability without having to wait for all your vendors to figure it out because you have the SBOM. So you can immediately know whether or not what your risk is, and that closure in the window of exposure, being able to put in mitigations or turn off software or put in additional controls, reduces your exposure. And that's an important thing. But it's also important to note that SBOM, while it's a big deal, it's also going to take some work. Developers have to change the way they do things to be able to document all the components, support a format that they can communicate that. And then most importantly, the end customers, whether that be the federal government or a bank, has to have a mechanism in place to consume that data and store it. So that it has to be able to take the SBOM, pull it apart, understand it, and put it in like their asset management database, so that they can leverage that information. Because if they just get the SBOM and say, check, we got one, and put it into a folder someplace and never look at it, we've gotten no benefit.
You already talked about some measures that the US government and the Biden administration took. What was it exactly? Can you explain this a bit more?
You know, last year and into this year, there was an executive order that was put out that highlighted a couple of key things. It highlighted the need for supply chain risk management. It highlighted the need for every agency to have a zero trust plan. And the need for the suppliers of software and services to the federal government needed to take a SBOM-like approach. Then the memorandum codified, that one came out later, codified that the timeframe. So one first one said, you've got to have a plan. The second one says, here's when you have to have the plan published. So all of the different agencies had to report, here's my plan at a certain date. Here's the steps we're going to take to adopt these technologies. Here are the standards that need to be developed. And so it really put a timeline and put the onus on the individual agencies to make it happen. And it also said, NIST, go put together a standard for how to do supply chain security, which they've published a draft now that it's floating around. I think it's NIST 800-207 is a standard that's currently in draft and is being reviewed of how to do supply chain risk management. And so those are the things that sort of codified that we need to do something better. And got the industry to open up, because one of the key tenets in there is that all, at some point, the contracting language of how the government buys software and licenses software and contracts for software to be developed is going to require supply chain risk management from those vendors, from those suppliers and developers. And so by codifying that into the executive order and the memorandum, it notified the entire ecosystem of software and hardware providers that they needed to start building this into their system so that we can be ready for when the government starts to require it as a contractual requirement for all new software and services being deployed.
How is that to be seen on the global level? I think there's not, never will be one common standard regarding supply chain security. There will be different approaches. And aren't there still remaining risks then, even when you look at China or Asia? Also, if you have this development of decoupling, is this connected to this topic, or how would you see this?
So I think one way to think about the global market is that software that's being developed, you know, in the US and even in the global scale that is adopted, you know, whether it be, you know, Microsoft Word or SAP or Siemens, everyone is a customer of the US government in the sense that the US government acquires software globally. But also it sets a stage for what needs to be done. So we've seen the global governments, not just the Five Eyes, but globally looking at supply chain risk management because of SolarWinds and other kinds of attacks. And the fact that NIST has published this documentation, you know, Germany may do a slightly different version, but it's going to be based on a lot on the same tenets of NIST, because NIST worked with the global ecosystem, worked with the global government. So there's representation across the world of what's needed. And a lot of governments will adopt similar approaches or leverage the NIST standards outright, depending on the government. And that's not, again, it's not just the Five Eyes, it's the global environment. We have to do better because supply chain risk management is important to everybody. And so whether that's the, you know, the Five Eyes, Australia, New Zealand, UK, it's the EU and the NATO nations, or it's African nations and even China, all are figuring out what does it mean to do supply chain risk management. And either they will develop their own standards, modify some of the ones that have been published, or just leverage them outright. The goal is to increase the security. And the benefit of having the major software providers and the open source community jump on this and adopt this is that the benefits service everybody.
So let's talk a bit about how to secure and to protect networks and critical infrastructures, actually. What are really recommended actions as of today? Can you give some examples?
Looking at the problem, there's the classics, what we call cyber hygiene, patching, vulnerability management, scanning and remediating things that you detect. That has to be done. That's important. But there are some key things that we've learned in the last several years that have to be deployed. And visibility, as I mentioned with the SolarWinds, is one key aspect. Understanding the things that you have, you can't secure what you don't know. And so asset management, supply chain risk management, having accurate dashboarding and reporting is a crucial part of both cyber hygiene, but also about how you do advanced threat protection. You've got to know what's going on in your environment and where your data sits, both in the cloud and at hosted providers, and what service providers are providing you data. Another key thing we've learned is around segmentation, and whether that be between the IT and the operational technology, or OT barriers, so with the edge to the inside and to the cloud, having those separated, data domains, so different regulatory environments, different criticalities, being able to separate the data, and then even doing segmentation across the network. And we're seeing zero trust really drive a lot of that as well, of micro-segmentation, leveraging software-defined networking. It really is about if you can create these segments and these strong barriers within the environment, when something does get hacked, because it will, you can limit the exposure and limit the scope and the scale. We all know that strong risk-based identity management is important. I think one of the challenges is that everyone gets focused on multi-factor authentication or two-factor authentication, and they stop once they get there. And the idea is that multi-factor authentication is absolutely critical, but it's a very early step. It's not the end game. The end game is a risk-based approach to applying security controls. So understanding what is the risk of the transaction, the risk to the data, the risk of this user, marrying that together to make accurate decisions around what data to be allowed to be accessed by whom and where. And then the last two things, one thing is the other threat we haven't talked about, but it's been in the news for the last several years, has been ransomware. And while ransomware ultimately is about being able to malware early in its life cycle, be able to prevent it from getting a foothold, the other piece of that puzzle is having really good disaster recovery and failover, and having good backups that are disconnected, and having a plan And that leads to the final thing, which is, again, part of cyber hygiene, but I can't stress this enough. Training and proper planning for when an event occurs, whether that be a data breach, whether that be a ransomware attack, whether that be a nation state or a supply chain, having a plan in place for what to do, the training for the individuals. And then the last piece here, which doesn't happen often enough, what I call gaming. Test the plan, run a game, run a war game where you run the event with all the different players having to operate so that you see, is your plan working? What worked? What didn't? What team was too slow to react because they didn't have the right information? And that's how you really provide that feedback loop for the training and for your planning and for your controls, is to run the process. Don't wait for you to get a data breach. Run a simulated data breach and see how the systems work.
So in theory, this all sounds very good and absolutely logical, but in practice, do companies really have time to spend on gaming and planning? I see also because there is regulation, but do they really prepare trainings in the way they should be doing it and, you know, running games? Do you think this is already done by the industry?
I think it's a work in progress. I think there are two things I would say. I say there are some really good mature organizations that do run games. One of the things I've seen is there are a lot of services organizations, managed security providers, consulting services that will help run the games for you. And I see a lot of companies now leveraging those because they don't have the resources themselves to really run a game. So they'll hire a company to come in and run the game with them. And again, this is still a work in progress. We're still early in the process here. But organizations that do game their systems see the benefit, not only in that it helps train their people, but it also gives their board, their management team, better risk information about how to respond to these kind of events so that they're not just waiting for something to go wrong and hoping for the best, but they actually have visibility and insight into how the organization would respond. What is the results? And what you find is those organizations that are doing it today, their boards, their executives, and their auditors are in a much better place and are much more confident when the CIO asks for dollars to spend on securing certain system or putting in certain controls, they can map it to something real. And so the board is much more amenable to those CIOs. So the CIOs that take on gaming and have that information available to prove why these controls are important or why this training is important, do a much better job in their budget cycle of being able to get things approved by the board when they need it. And so you find that mature organizations are starting to are really doing it. The next tier in that, you know, sort of that crossing the chasm are starting to leverage resources. But we still have some ways to go before this becomes the rigor for everybody. In the startup world, we're seeing companies, you know, like Safe Breach and others that are providing the sort of like software and tools as a service to be able to simulate this, to make it, again, easier for your medium-sized companies or even for large companies that don't have those resources to be able to game certain parts of their systems and see what would happen in the case of a breach and see what would be targeted. So we are seeing a lot of innovation, both at the services side as well as in the startup ecosystem to help organizations. But we've got a ways to go. Absolutely.
Okay, so it sounds like there are many business opportunities for startup companies if they want to do something in this area. So looking at the geopolitical situation, we have, of course, other problems coming up with the war in Ukraine and other threat scenarios with crisis hotspots worldwide. Also, we experience here related cyber attacks. And how do you evaluate this regarding the political landscape?
So the environment we're sitting in today is a hot cyber escalation. We are absolutely seeing an escalation of attacks globally, both, you know, related to the war in Ukraine, related to geopolitical situations, you know, globally in the South China Sea and other places. And while we've always seen attacks in political hotspots, I think right now, just because the current political environment globally, the geopolitical environment is really active, we're seeing the cyber domain be equally active. So we are seeing attacks. One of the things that, especially in the Ukraine situation, there's been some really good articles about this. We've seen some interesting internal fighting between the threat actors. And what you found is that, you know, there have been examples where Ukrainian teams that were once sort of allied with certain cybercritical organizations are now attacking them or publishing information. So we've seen source code from various different ransomware products being published. At the same time, one of the things we're seeing is that it's not just nation states that are being targeted. It's not just the US or the EU. And so we're seeing private sector, critical infrastructure, interest globally being targeted and attacked. And so it's important to recognize is that when you're looking at, do I need to secure myself? everyone is a potential target. We saw that with the ransomware, that it could be a capital pipeline or it could be the JBS meatpacking industry. Everyone could be a target of these kind of cyber attacks. And so the current situation is, it's definitely an escalation. We're seeing much more attacks. We're seeing a lot more target attacks. And it basically is justifying that we need to have the proper security controls. We can't wait until we've been breached to then do better security for our data. We have to be proactive here.
In the near future, what do you think, how will the challenges develop?
So I think some of the challenges we're seeing in the near future, number one, we're seeing a lot more collaboration and joint activities. And so in the past, where everyone was their own little domain, we are truly an interconnected society, whether that be at the US government level or the global private sector. We are truly interconnected. We are leveraging cloud services. We are trying to do, you know, joint capabilities, being able to provide citizen services or banking services that require working on mobile phones. That interconnectedness requires a joint security solution, whether that be proper information sharing, being able to do data sharing, collaboration, and joint missions. Those changes in the landscape, both from a threat perspective, but also in a security perspective. And this is why we're seeing the move to zero trust and the move to a risk-based approach, is because you can't just rely on your protections alone. Your data exists outside or in other people's hands, or you're being serviced by third parties. So you have to think about the end-to-end and where your data sits. And that's why a data-centric security and risk-based controls are absolutely going to be the trend we see going forward. The other thing that I think is really interesting, and we're seeing some of the requirements today, but it's going to continue, is what I call the cyber embedded in everything. IoT, Internet of Things, whether that be your car, you know, household appliances, your phone, they are all internet-enabled devices. And the idea of, well, somebody else will secure it, or I'll get a firewall, and those days are gone. And so what we are starting to see is everything is going to have some security inside embedded or have an embedded capability. And the legacy systems are going to need to be managed appropriately, because we can't rely on legacy security for the new threat landscape.
Absolutely. How do you manage that in your professional life? How do you prepare for a cyber attack?
So for me, there are sort of five or six things that you do. Number one, multi-factor authentication. So whether it be my online accounts, my access to my phones, you have multi-factor. You need to have it today. The good news is it's not hard. Your phone is a great factor that you can get multi-factor or token-based apps for your phone. There are a variety of them. They actually now all interoperate with each other. So you can use Google Authenticator, Microsoft Authenticator, Duo Security, and leverage them on multiple sites. So number one is multi-factor. And then the other thing, as I mentioned this earlier, is a key thing we've got to do, and it's visibility. So for me, it's about monitoring, checking what's going on, looking at the data, monitoring your personal finances, your emails. You've got to be vigilant and monitoring your systems and making sure that they're still secure. Turn on security. Keep your antivirus update. Turn on all the security features. Get rid of default passwords. All that sort of cyber hygiene you have to do. And then the last two is having good backups. And notice I use the plural there. It's not one backup. Multiple backups. So that your critical data and the things you need to, whether it be professionally or personally, you need to be able to run your life, that you have it in multiple places. And I found that it's important, not just from a security event, but if you're suddenly on the road and you need to be able to access, you know, a picture of your passport to be able to go stay in a hotel, having a picture in Dropbox or something like that that's secured that you can show on demand. It's that kind of need of being able to know that your data can be anywhere. And so having your data backed up in multiple places. And the key thing for me is both online in a secured storage as well as offline, you know, on a USB stick that's disconnected.
I thought that USB sticks are out of scope.
So a lot of federal environments, they still use DVDs and CDs. But for my personal and for a lot of the data, you have one USB stick that has your most important information, like your private key, if you use PGP or SMIME, your most critical documents and things like that. And you have that and you lock it away.
You lock it in the safe then.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
Okay.
And the last thing is then redundancy. So having the ability to recover or to be able to fail over is another key piece of the puzzle. Making sure that when something goes wrong, it's not just I have my data, but I also have systems that I can recover to, or I can get back to a known good state.
Well, thank you, Steve, for sharing all these valuable insights. And thank you for the really good conversation. I learned a lot. Take care and stay safe.
Thank you very much, Sabine. It was a pleasure to be here today.
Safety First is TÜV Süd's podcast on cybersecurity and more. Audio production by Ikone Media.